I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. James Harkin joins me now. He is the author of Lost in Cyberbia, How Life on the Net Has Created a Life of Its Own. It's a fascinating book on how we are changing thanks to the internet age and all that it entails, the technology and social networking. We are, it seems, constantly in the information loop, and the enthusiasm for that has spread even to the sort of films and television shows we watch. There are upsides, but Mr. Harkin also discusses the downside, where the attention spans are shortened, narratives are discarded, and being connected doesn't mean what we'd like it to, that communication really isn't what it used to be or what it is meant to be. James Harkin is a futurologist, writer, and social forecaster. He is a director of talks at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, and he contributes regularly to The Guardian and The Financial Times. In the 1990s, he taught and lectured at Oxford. The book is published by Knopf in Toronto this day. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, James Harkin. Good morning, Mr. Harkin.
Good morning, John.
Thanks for joining us. What is a futurologist?
Wow, that's a good question, isn't it? A futurologist is a rather big category. It includes anybody predicting the future from between 6 months and 50 years. I was probably what's called a kind of short-term futurologist, more of a kind of trend spotter, trying to kind of divine patterns in the social ether and advise companies and institutions something about changing demographic and technological trends. But, you know, it's a highly unregulated business, Joe, and many futurologists kind of often roll up with very little qualifications for doing that, and I think that they've often been rumbled by companies, and many of them have discovered that there's no future in it, really.
So this, in the book, you talk about cyberbia. When you talk about that, I mean, where is that? What does that all entail?
Cyberbia is a way of describing what's happened to us in the last 5 years, the kind of movement in which many of us have begun zoning out at work or disappearing off from the front room into the spare room to stare at each other on blogs, on Facebook profiles, on Google. And the idea of being lost in cyberbia is the image comes from this kind of very addictive place that we've all slowly and very quietly migrated to stare at each other. In the same way that in stereotypical suburbia in the 1950s, housewives used to stare out their windows. Suburbia is this strange place in which people make fitful attempts to communicate one another, a place punctuated by secrets and intrigue and filled with, you know, illicit encounters and the endless twitching of curtains.
Now, you talk about being stuck in this information loop, right? And that's one of the causes of all this technology, the email and our gadgets, and not only our gadgets, but what we do on our gadgets. This leads us to being in this information loop, leaves us to being constantly interrupted, and that we're unable to sit back and reflect. How different is this than, say, television or radio or any other sort of distractions from the past?
Oh, it's hugely different from television. I mean, one of the arguments in my book is that the traditional couch potato is an endangered species, you know, sitting and passively watching TV. TV is a very passive act. It's always been, satirized by people precisely because it is very passive. You're a couch potato. You just sit there and absorb in a very formless way what's on the little television in the corner. To be actively engaged in an information loop, as I call it, in places like eBay, Facebook, email, text, you're constantly and actively engaged in that information loop because you're part of it. And you have to be constantly sending out messages into the ether and rapidly responding to feedback from that information loop. You're an active player in that. And what slightly worries me is that if people spend too long constantly sending out messages and being rapidly responsive to feedback and enjoying that, then they often might be unable to sit back and appreciate not only a bad television program, but maybe a work of art. You know, I think people have lost the ability to be passive, and what's ironic is that we spent 20 years criticizing couch potatoes. Maybe we need to relearn how to be passive again, at least in some context.
So how do we remedy that? How do we get away from being, well, you know, I mean, it's okay to use eBay if you're buying something that you need, but when you become obsessed with it, as someone like myself has been, where I'm constantly checking things, even though and buying things that really I don't need. How do you deal with someone like me then?
Well, it's a difficult and very finely grained argument to make. Because on the one hand, as you rightly point out, lots of these sites are very, very useful. eBay is very, very useful. I use it all the time. There's a difference between using something because you want to buy something, and what you have is an incredible, selection from all around the world on eBay of things to purchase, and people becoming obsessed with being in that information loop. So simply checking the price of their goods on eBay, or checking what price the auction has arrived at, and disappearing off to the spare room at 3 o'clock in the morning to bid for something, that's something which has become out of control. My book isn't a Jeremiah. It doesn't say that, you know, we've all got the hand in a handcart. It doesn't say that the internet's making us stupid or illiterate. What it does say is that it's often very self-defeating, as well as bad for us, to spend too much time actively engaged in this information loop, in a closed information loop, and that we would do better and get more out of the time that we do spend online and make more productive use of it if we stepped back and were able to cut ourselves off from that loop. So maybe spend a day without email, maybe, you know, throw our BlackBerries away for the weekend, or find creative ways in which we can, or creative times of the day in which we can step back from this and say, okay, I'm going to do email between 2 and 4 p.m. A writer was just telling me that he tells his readers, I'm going to respond to email between 2 and 4 p.m. After that, I'm not going to be on there. So all I'm saying is that we need to be, to take a step back and be out of the loop in order to be, get its full fruit.
And you find that that works? I mean, like, I had eye surgery a couple of weeks ago, and I sort of made this vow to myself that I wouldn't use my BlackBerry for about a day or so.
Mm.
And I must admit, I did not succeed.
I know. It is like a very visceral addiction, and that's why I'm fascinated by what this information loop is. It's a game of sending out messages, responding to feedback, and it's a game which never ends, because there's always feedback coming back. And so I think it is incredibly difficult, and I don't, you know, exclude myself from this, but all I can suggest is that people need to try harder, really.
Facebook, why is Facebook bad? I mean, where do you think that it's gone wrong?
I think Facebook is a very, very useful tool, but again, if you keep it within its proper remit, if you use it to get messages out there about what you're up to and keep track of friends and family, as it turns out, you know, only 10%, according to Facebook's own statistics, of people that we have as friends on Facebook are our friends. The rest are this kind of loose electronic diaspora of people who we often don't know that well. And one of the things I've got really fascinated by about in the book, and this isn't only a sociological argument, it's an argument which is proven in lots of different academic fields, that if you spend all your time staring at what other people are up to, especially people you don't know very well, then often you don't end up getting around to something original yourself. In other words, all of these hopes that we had for the internet from the 60s and the 70s in terms of making us more individualistic creatures who were better at self-expression, if you spend too much time on the internet, especially with these popularity contests that are often held there, these are incredibly conformist places. People often tend to make the same decisions as everyone else, and that's another very good reason why we need to take a step back from this information feedback loop and not set too much store by it. I mean, can I give you an example?
Sure.
Barack Obama, on day 66 of his administration, inaugurated something called the Online Town Hall, whereby he invited Americans to show up and to vote or to ask questions and that should be addressed to him. Now, 92,000 Americans did show up and they asked questions. It turned out that the four top questions in the economy section were all about the decriminalization of dope. The four top questions in the section about the budget were the same, and the top question in the section about green jobs was, why not decriminalize dope and make it into a growth industry, and that way we might see the economic signs of, you know, the green shoots of recovery, literally. What had happened there was something very interesting. In the first place, a very small lobby organization had got all its members to turn up and ask questions. that's pretty normal. It happens in all democracies. Lobbyists try and control things. What happened next was much more interesting. The people who showed up after the initial dope smoking lobby simply buzzed up exactly the same questions that had been asked before them. In other words, when you're put in a kind of ocean of online information and you see people who've been there before you, and there are a very small amount of them, you're liable, and this has been proven again and again in academic research, to simply choose what the person chose exactly before you. In other words, these popularity contests or attempts at democracy on the internet turn into a game of follow the leader. They're incredibly conformist places. And when the President of the United States is beginning to assume that this is an appropriate form of democracy, I think we all need to worry. The peer pressure that goes on, which is specific to the medium, it doesn't imply that all those people are stupid. There's something very specific to the medium, which is a kind of claustrophobia or peer pressure. And if we invest too much of our energy in this and set too much store by it, I think we're in real trouble.
No, we've talked about how email, text messaging, social networking sites have all become indispensable to our lives. So I'm wondering, how did we let that happen?
Well, there are very good kind of, you know, empirical and technological reasons. Around about the year 1999 or 2000, there was a sudden and catastrophic collapse in the dot-com economy. What happened then was that all of these companies had spent a huge amount of money putting broadband pipes in the ground, putting these copper wire and fiber optic cables in the ground, and no one had any use for them anymore because the whole dot-com economy had exploded. After that, it was almost like the infrastructure had been laid out, and we, ordinary people, slowly began to migrate and use these broadband pipes because no one else was. So there was a slow and very spontaneous migration of millions of people to spend time on what you might call the people's net, on sites where they could simply hang out with each other. And I think that's really interesting. For a start, it eats up a huge amount of our time. It soaked up watercolor conversation, people spending their afternoons on Facebook. What interests me specifically, and what interests me more and more, even since I wrote the book, is the fact that it soaks up what some people call our cognitive surplus. In other words, and this comes back to your previous point, Joe, the time that we would have previously spent on a train, sitting there, ruminating on our thoughts, or sitting on a park bench doing absolutely nothing, that kind of cognitive surplus, that time that we spent simply daydreaming, is now soaked up by pressing buttons. And that's really interesting. If you're an internet guru, and there are quite a few internet gurus who are incredibly positive about this world out there, they will say that the internet is soaking up our cognitive surplus in interesting ways because, you know, these can be used in fruitful places like Wikipedia where we kind of create encyclopedias. But the alternative argument is that, you know, what's wrong with simply daydreaming? And isn't there a value to simply controlling your own train of thought, daydreaming, and thinking about nothing in particular? Because often that's when you arrive at some of your most creative thoughts. The danger is, with the growth of the people's net and these kind of self-organized sites which are fueled by all of our energy pressing buttons, is that we lose the energy to sit back and have much more creative thoughts and stay out of the loop.
You also talk in the book about the effect that it's had on the prefrontal cortex. On our brains, and you look at some of the research over that. Well, what did you find out?
Well, I mean, Joe, the research is all inconclusive. I lay it out at its current state. Anyone who tells you that they know for final and for good that the internet is rotting our brains is probably a charlatan. What we do know is, and the current state of neuroscientific research suggests, that our brains are much more malleable than we once thought. What we know about the prefrontal cortex is that this is a part of the brain which is capable of managing lots of different things, like a kind of executive controller. And I think there's a good argument, or a good speculative argument, which suggests that the more demands we make on that, the more fragmented our attention spans are, and the more streams of information that are coming in. For the first growth in that, we're able to become much more nimble. So many younger people especially are very, very good at managing different kind of information streams, you know, looking at text, while they're having a conversation, while they're staring at a computer screen. But beyond a certain point, the productivity bonus, which comes from that, diminishes, and we end up almost stoned, or at least kind of too tired by all these demands made on our brain. And at that point, I think the productivity bonus vanishes, and we're left in a worse state than we were. In other words, and it's pretty simple, if you make too many demands on your brain with too many information streams by spending too much time on different information loops, that's going to have a negative effect. I mean, there was a study done on American workers in 2004, American office workers, which suggested that they interrupted or were interrupted themselves every 3 minutes, and often it took them 25 minutes to get back to work. The interesting part of that is, and this was almost like a kind of postscript to the research, is that often those workers were interrupting themselves. They wanted to be interrupted because they were pretty bored in their jobs, like many of us, and they saw this as, you know, time out, losing themselves in suburbia, staring at internet profiles, replying to texts. It wasn't at all about being more efficient. It was something that they enjoyed.
And you find that even though we were writing emails to one another, text messaging one another, that in terms of communication itself, that's deteriorated over the years?
I wouldn't say that precisely. I don't think that, you know, something like texting, for example, is causing problems with literacy. I think that it's not true to say that we're communicating more. We're spending more time on an electronic information loop, firing messages back and forth, but that isn't any real kind of communication. I mean, the communication that I'm having with you, or the communication that I was having with you if you were here, it's a conversation. You can interpret that this conversation as the exchange of packets of data, but it's not really. It's based on contextual cues, and those contextual cues would be even stronger were you here. I think that the stuff that we do on Facebook, the stuff that we do in text, isn't communication. It's message exchange. And I think that if we were to spend too much time in message exchange and too little time in communication, that would be bad. But I'm not sure whether the real face time or the conversation time that we're getting is diminishing. I do know that we're spending way too much time simply sending packets of messages back and forth.
Now, back to this idea here of you mentioned the online thing that Obama did recently, where you found that it seemed to become quite conformist. Did you think that the internet has gone astray a bit, where it was seen as sort of a do-it-yourself, ground-up movement, sort of like Wikipedia, but it's become sort of, I wouldn't say corporate, but I mean, even that, one could say that it's become corporate, couldn't we?
I'm not sure whether you would see the internet as having become more corporate. I mean, you could say the opposite. Certainly, around about 1999, the internet was full of flashy websites and sponsored by companies. That all kind of was demolished by the dot-com boom, and what we're seeing now is much more amateur, in a way. Part of what we're talking about is the growing amateurization of the internet. But let's come back to your... What was your initial question before that?
You were talking earlier about that Obama thing, where it became quite conformist, where we sort of... The people that were doing this poll... tended to answer questions because of what other people did rather than what they thought.
Well, this is a brilliant irony, I think, because, you know, I trace the origins of the internet in the book back to this idea called cybernetics, and you can trace that from the Second World War. You can trace that as it passed through the American military-industrial complex into the hippie movement in the late 60s and early 70s. But certainly when the hippies grabbed hold of this idea of cybernetics. And we must remember that long before the internet, people had the idea about what the internet should be and what political function it should have. And the reason why hippies and electro-hippies in California were so big on the internet was because they presumed that it would lend itself to a much more individualistic kind of society. What they were interested in was burrowing around a faceless, conformist, stultifying bureaucracy, which they saw as controlling American life. But the brilliant irony is that in this world that we call Web 2.0 or the people's net, it turns out that when we spend too much of our time online, we're almost lost in this kind of sea of online information, and in search of any direction, we're simply keen to follow any leader, which is why if you have any popularity contest on the People's Net for, you know, which is the most popular unknown band, for example, what happens and what has been proven to happen in academic studies is that simply people follow the leader. This isn't like real life. This is a world in which you have a million different choices, but faced with those million different choices and an abundance of information with very little time, what has been proven to happen again and again is that whoever rose up first, everyone follows the leader. So the decisions that are made are not only conformist, they're deeply conservative and often highly predictable because it depends on who rose up first.
So I'm going to ask you to put your futurologist hat on. Well, what do you think the effect of this economic crisis will be in all of this? Will we retreat to our computers more and more, or less, perhaps?
I think this is only going to kind of retrench people. You know, spending time online on the internet is pretty cheap in bald economic terms. With my futurological hat on, the way that we're going now is towards what I would call the final crack-up of mainstream culture. In other words, the mainstream culture that we saw for the last 10 years slowly dissipating, you know, the kind of mainstream TV stations, the BBCs and the kind of ABCs in America, are slowly cracking up and being replaced by a whole host of niche players. And the way out of this place that I call suburbia is in a place where people have lots of different niches. And TV stations and newspapers, and everyone focuses on precisely what their niche is. The danger, I think, and the real mistake that our rulers have made in the last couple of years is by listening to kind of huckster internet gurus who told them that as long as people were chatting about you, anybody was chatting about you anywhere on the internet, that was a good thing. The future of media, as people are quickly realizing, is in tightly knit, very focused little groups of people who are scattered all around the world, and for that you need to be focused. For that you don't need to be on Twitter chattering away. Chatter is meaningless. What you need is a very focused idea of who you are and a very focused audience which is prepared to come from all over the world because of the internet to find you.
This is a terribly fascinating book, and the same for the conversation. I've enjoyed the book and I've enjoyed talking to you today, James. Continued good luck with the book.
Thanks, Joe.
The book is called Lost in Cyberbia, How Life on the Net Has Created a Life of Its Own. It's author James Harkin on the line. I'm Joseph Plana.